Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There's all these little satisfactory moments of solving the puzzle, whether it's the people in the breakfast nook who are solving the cipher, or, you know, whether it's like finding these little pieces of evidence, or the scene where they interview Arthur Lee Allen, which is so just masterclass of like acting and editing and staging and where to put the camera. And, you know, and then and we're doing this with Graysmith, and he's running around in the rain and writing things down on a napkin, and we're in this experience, and we're unlocking the clues, and we're doing the game, and the game has no end, and the game will not let us win, and the goddamn handwriting is going to kick us every single time. So there is something sort of like it's almost like edging.
Why don't you define it for the listeners?
I don't want to. It's like not orgasming.
Going to the edge, right. One might say. To the precipice.
But yeah, I mean, this movie is like 2.5
Katie
hours
is blushing,
of like edging.
Is blushing so hard right now. I haven't seen you blush like this on a show before.
Welcome to Zodiac Chronicle, a 24-part investigation into David Fincher's 2007 genre-altering masterpiece, Zodiac. Adapted from Robert Graysmith's novel by screenwriter James Vanderbilt, the film, of course, stars an incredible ensemble cast led by Jake Gyllenhaal, Robert Downey Jr., and Mark Ruffalo. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Our introduction today was the Los Angeles-based film critic and journalist for the Tribune News Service and LA Times, part-time lecturer at Chapman University, and the co-host of our monthly Miami Nice podcast, Katie Walsh. Before we dive into the theme of the week in the show proper, I'd love to remind you to jump on and rate and follow and subscribe and review to the show wherever you're listening. It's a huge help for those fellow film lovers out there to find our obsessive cinematic deep dives. And I also want to let you know that links to our Patreon with a weekly Rum and Rant podcast and special uncut Zodiac Sessions interviews, as well as all the links to our merchandise with artwork from the incredible Brianna Ashby and Amy Reed, are all in the show notes and the show description or at oneheatminute.com. Joining me to sit in the smoking section with Mr. Paul Avery are award-winning author, film critic, host of the terrific and insightful Watch with Jen podcast, my friend, Jen Johans. Zodiac screenwriter, James Vanderbilt, editor-at-large at RogerEbert.com, TV critic at Vulture, Matt Solazites, filmmaker and screenwriter of Rounders, The Girlfriend Experience, Ocean's 13, and co-creator and showrunner of Billions, Brian Koppelman, senior contributor at Film School Rejects, Meg Shields, and writer, actor, and one of the stars of this incredible ensemble, Zodiac, Donal Logue. This is the 12th episode of Zodiac Chronicle, Gemini, Part 2. In this sequence, we play third wheel to the most interesting first date and watch Paul Avery step out of the newsroom, into the limelight, and then straight back to the smoking section. Every episode, we've used a film title to encapsulate our theme. This episode shows that writing is on the wall for Robert Graysmith's relationships. And because I took my wife to arguably the worst date movie ever for our first movie date, I thought it would be only appropriate that I give the theme to the movie I took her to. So, this episode's theme is Blue Valentine. Here's the screenwriter of Zodiac, James Vanderbilt, discussing how he and Fincher had perverse aspirations for this scene.
It's sort of the worst first date you can imagine. He's super late. He says he's come from a gun range. He and then says that his friend might be in mortal peril, and then needs to borrow money from her to make a phone call to warn his friend that it might be in mortal peril. So it's sort of this, and she's kind of interested by that, you know? I do remember one of Fincher's favorite jokes is in that scene where Jake says, you know, Paul Avery, I work near him. As though the idea, the actual physical geographical proximity to his desk is like, it's not that I work with him, I work near him. So I always sort of love that that piece of it. But yeah, she's you know, she's sort of normalcy, right? She represents what a normal person would do, what a normal life is. And I think we sort of worked really hard to make her not be shrewish about it. You know, she's indulgent and she'll allow him to do this stuff. But once he starts, you know, letting Herb Cain write about it, and once he starts going on the news about it, she's like, you know, we have kids, dude. Like, what are you doing?
And now, let's get to the scene.
I'm looking for a Melanie.
Yes, it's the young lady.
Thank you.
Taking wide, awkward, stilt-like steps to avoid puddles, Jake Gyllenhaal's Robert Graysmith, wearing a newspaper draped over his head, rushes into a fancy restaurant in the rain. Sodden, and still wearing clothes from a day working and accompanying Robert Downey Jr.'s Paul Avery to a gun range, Graysmith fumbles his way into a restaurant and to the disapproving cashier and greeter. They each give off the vibe of a husband and wife and disapproving parents, pointing this hapless suitor to his date. There's a working class edge to this restaurant, punching above its weight, delivering a prologue to the upper class corporate eateries we saw packed from lunch to late in the pre-COVID world. Graysmith, as if determined to start ticking every red flag on the blind date bingo, even asked the maitre d' to point him towards his date. As much for Melanie as for Graysmith, she supportively obliges. Graysmith looks towards Chloe Sevigny's Melanie, a picture of matter-of-fact yet luminous 70s beauty. 7 years to this point, typified a post-Tarantino, unabashedly American indie actor, starring in raw, insular performances in Boys Don't Cry, American Psycho, Dogville, The Brown Bunny, and Shattered Glass, to name a few. Those roles required risk, bravery, and here is Melanie underneath the turtleneck sweater and large spectacles, is a kind of repressed adventurousness. Here's James Vanderbilt with a quick aside about his personal connection to Miss Sevigny.
Yeah, and the fun thing too about Chloe, well, first of all, the funny thing is Chloe and I actually did children's theater together when we were kids. So like, she grew up in the town next to me. So it was super amazing that she got cast in this, you know what I mean? So that was just fun to see her again. But then also, especially around this time, like she was like indie movie darling. She was doing all these sort of risky things. And then she comes in and plays sort of the most straight-laced, normal, like, you know, character in the whole movie, and she knocks it out of the park. So she gives the kind of the gravity to understanding, and also humanizes, I think, Graysmith, who is, you know, a space cadet in a lot of ways. Like, you know, it brings some normalcy into his life, and you kind of go, well, if she likes him, you know, he can't be all bad.
You must be Melanie.
Which would make you Robert.
I would. Glennis told me lots about you. And you have wine. Great.
I do.
Great. How late am I?
It's just a few minutes, really. I just got here myself.
Traffic, bumper to bumper. It's at the gun range.
Glenna said you were a cartoonist.
Oh, yeah.
What are you doing at the gun range?
Reading. Is it, get some more... You need some more napkins. Oh, so you work with Glennis?
For her, actually.
For her? Oh. Well, my children are terrified of Glennis.
Me too.
Oh.
So the gun range.
Oh, we were, I'm working on, do you know the Zodiac?
Yeah.
I'm working with, do you know who Paul Avery is?
Sounds kind of familiar.
He's the writer that the Zodiac threatened.
Oh, yeah, I saw that on TV.
Well, I work near him, and he's going down tonight to track an anonymous tipster down in Riverside. Where is Riverside?
It's near L.A.
Oh, wow. I don't think Paul knows that it's that far away.
Sounds kind of dangerous.
Yeah. How do you mean?
Well, you said it was an anonymous tip, right?
Yeah.
So it could be an ambush. It could be the Zodiac.
Oh.
Don't you think it's kind of stupid?
Yeah. Well, Paul has a gun.
It's beautiful. Confounding foible after foible. I've heard so much about you, and yet Graysmith immediately miffs her job. The lack of polish on Graysmith has a disarming quality on Melanie. The gun range, the involvement in the Zodiac case, I sit near Paul Avery, the location of Riverside, and the concept of a nighttime meeting with a stranger, all of these are ringing alarm bells for Melanie. And she demonstrates that those cues are threats to Graysmith. Threats that up until this point, he'd never considered.
Paul has a gun.
So, you know what's good here?
I've never been here before. the pasta, spaghetti.
Are you ready to order yet?
Yeah, I'll have the penne vodka, but could you do it in a cream sauce?
Of course.
7 years Melanie looks at the impact of her danger assessment and Graysmith's lack of engagement with the menu, the lack of assertion on the meal, even the deferral to say that they need more time to order from the imposing and rotund belly of the faceless waiter. Another great, beautiful touch that signals that the waitstaff maintain a sort of frank diner-style quality delivery to their request of their order rather than hot cuisine. Graysmith is blinded by his game perception stakes of this case. The stakes are life and death.
Maybe give us another minute.
Do you have any change? Oh, wait, no, wait, hold on. No, that's a penny.
Do you have to make a phone call?
Yeah, you know, when you were saying that the Zodiac... when you said it was dangerous, I just thought that it is dangerous, and it's...
Stupid?
Stupid, and I just thought that I should call his wife and just see if she's heard from him.
I have some change.
Here's writer and author Jan Johans on how women are so integral to sensing the danger of the Zodiac.
Fincher and Vanderbilt and everyone working on the movie kind of knew that women were probably the first victim, and we sense this danger. Like, we're the first victim of the Zodiac.
Yes.
We're the ones that sense this danger and also try to, you know, placate or, you know, have the guy we're with stay alive, like, don't get out of the car, or, hey, this guy is coming towards us. Just like the scene that I kind of selected for today, the one I love, The First Date, is it takes an outsider to kind of evaluate these men's obsession. Like, wait, he's going down to Riverside, Paul Avery, for an anonymous tip. Like, he could just be walking into a trap. It could be the Zodiac, like, he could be dead. And it's like it never occurred to Eagle Scout Jake Gyllenhaal's character, Robert Graysmith. Like he's trying to kind of disengage to, like, go through with this. I'm assuming it was a blind date because it didn't seem like he knew what she looked like.
Nah.
And, but then he's like looking for change, like, oh God, I got to call his wife. Like, you know, this might be a thing. And so I love that it takes a woman, and it also takes an outsider looking in, just like we talked about our tunnel vision, and we need somebody. Like, one of my friends would text me occasionally, like, you know, are you still working on your paper? Like, did you even eat? And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure I did. What did you have? Oh, wait, you know, that was yesterday. Or yes. So it does take an outsider. But I like that in this movie, they're mostly females. Again, it's Arthur Lee Allen's sister-in-law who confirms the weird spelling of Christmas. She saw him with the ciphers. She's the one that cornered the shrink to break confidentiality to tell him that, yeah, this guy probably is capable of killing someone. So they're kind of the MVPs behind the scenes here of sensing danger and helping figure things out before it's too late. But unfortunately, like a police officer told me at one time, it's like, you can do everything right, but if somebody is determined to hurt you, they will hurt you.
If she's heard from him.
Well, I have some change.
Okay, well, she said she'd call when she heard from her.
Good.
Yeah. Melanie, I should go home and wait for the call.
Is this some sleazy plan to get me to go home with you?
What? No.
I'll get the food to go.
Hello?
Here's Brian Koppelman with a few words about just the incredible performance all round by Chloe Sevigny's Zodiac, and then onto a conversation with Matt Zoller-Zeitz about this scene's distillation of living life in the 1970s.
The only thing you can do, which is funny because Fincher's always considered cold as a filmmaker, but right there in the middle of the movie is Chloe Sevigny, who's the warmest, most inviting, ready to be loved person. And Graysmith can't choose her, and he can't choose that version of a humble happiness. He has to choose a kind of glory that the Zodiac wants, and Tosky wants, and Paul wants, and everybody wants.
One of the other things, one of the many things I love about Zodiac is its portrait of life in the 70s. And what makes it so remarkable for me is that, like Mad Men,
yeah,
and really a kind of a bare handful of period pieces made in recent years, it goes beyond like, here's somebody in a wide lapelled shirt and there's disco music playing, you know? Like, that's kind of like the lazy person's way to set something quote unquote in period. And they really thought about, like, how did people live back then? Like, there's as much thought put into this movie, which is set in the before, you know, right before Altamont and the, you know, if 67 was the summer of love, 69 was the summer of shit. Like, that was when everything turned to shit.
Yeah, it is.
And, yeah, and then it continues through the 70s. It just keeps going. The bodies keep piling up. They're unable to catch this guy or even identify him. Crime detection was different back then, and so was life generally. And to me, the scene in the restaurant distills all that in quite a brilliant way. It does a lot of things. It's this scene between Robert and Melanie is really, really doing a lot of work. It's you know, for one thing, it captures what it was like to be alive in the 70s better than almost any single scene I think I've seen outside of a movie made in the 70s.
Yes.
You know, because, you know, the decor of the restaurant, the way the people are dressed, all that stuff is spot on. But more importantly, it's it captures that feeling of being exposed. You know, that's the thing, is like there's a perception that life is more dangerous now than ever before, and the world is a bigger, scarier place than ever before. But, you know, being in my early 50s now and having witnessed all of this change, I don't feel that way. Like, I feel like there may be more people in the world now, but I feel like it's a much smaller world than the one that I was a child in.
Yes.
Because, you know, in the 70s, there were no smartphones. There was no internet.
Yeah.
There were no even pagers, really, at that point. Like, there were the equivalent of pagers, and there were the equivalent of, you know, cordless wireless phones. And we see, like, rich people in 60s movies have them in their limousines and stuff. But it wasn't a thing that everybody had. And if you got lost, if you were going to see somebody and you got lost, you couldn't GPS it, you had a map in your car. Sometimes if you lived in a big city, you had a book of maps in your car. You could buy a book of maps for Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, Dallas, where I'm from. But there was even a company called Mapsco that put them out, and you had to figure out how to flip the page from one grid to another as you were traveling without wrecking your car.
Go down to E7, continue, each side has continue on page 103. And like, if you were
exactly.
playing I remember navigating for both my mom and my dad, and they're like, where do I go? Wait, I've just got to flip to 103.
You're turning the page and then you're like, it's like grid G3 or something. Yes, that's what it was. Or you wrote the directions down. Somebody told you on the phone how to get there, and you wrote them down with a pencil or pen on a piece of paper, and you better pray to God that you didn't lose that piece of paper. Because if you did, you had to find a payphone and you had to call that person and hope that they picked up.
Yes.
So that you can say, I'm lost and I'm late. How do I get to your house? Do you have any idea how many times I've done that in my life? You know, prior to about 2000 or something, whenever I got my first flip phone. It's also a lovely meet cute. It's a really kind of lovely, ghastly meet cute. And, you know, it was perfect for me at the time because I was dating a woman who was really into true crime and thrillers and, you know, autopsy shows and things like that. So this was an absolutely perfect date film for the two of us. And it was very much like, you know, our first date was, you know, spent talking about a fair amount of it was about murderers, you know, like it's a topic. It's a thing. It was a thing, like he was into it. And it was like, Ted Bundy and the Zodiac Killer and the Night Stalker and all of this stuff is, you know, it's interesting in the same way that like gangsters are interesting. You can have a, you know, certain types of people can have a conversation about, you know, the Gambino crew for like an hour, you know, it's just a thing, but you know, that's kind of what this turns into. And I love that it's like, you know, she ends up, you know, there's something special between them when they're in that phone booth together. And she's like, is this a creepy attempt to trap me into going back to your place? But she goes willingly. And
yes.
In fact, I think she would have been disappointed if he hadn't asked to go.
Yes.
And then you see her sleeping on that couch and you're like, all right, these two are going to go the distance, you know? It's great. And yet it's doing that work. It's doing that work of setting up this relationship, but it's also doing the yeoman's work of exposition and explication of, you know, what's next in this ongoing story of trying to identify and catch the Zodiac. But, you know, going back to my earlier point, like that feeling of being exposed, of being basically naked and powerless when you were in a public space, not just in broad daylight, you know, I mean, I just got through reading a book called The Last Stone, which is about the abduction of one barely pubescent girl and her kid sister from a mall in like 1975. And you know, how that case was finally solved. And, you know, it's almost unthinkable that something like this could happen now, but like in 1975, like a creep could abduct a couple of kids from a shopping mall.
Yeah.
And maybe get away with it. Maybe get away with it because, you know, there were people who thought they might have maybe seen something weird going on, but they weren't really paying attention to it, and they couldn't describe the car. There was a lot of disagreement about the car that was used, things of that nature, and you're really relying on memory, and most places didn't have video surveillance. Now almost everybody does.
Mm.
And memories are unreliable, you know, they everybody knows that, and it was just easier to be a killer, it was easier to be a criminal. back then. And like, you know, if you want proof, all you got to do is look at procedurals now. What's the first thing that happens when the cops come to visit a murder scene on Law and Order? They ask about, you know, do you have cameras here? And they're like, yeah, but they're broken. Or yeah, but the lens is dirty. Or yeah, but whatever. There's always a reason why they can't just go to the tape. Because if they could just go to the tape, episodes of Law and Order would be like 14 minutes long.
Three minutes long. Oh, there's the guy.
You wouldn't even need the order part. You know? And that scene in Zodiac captures that so brilliantly. And it somehow combines that feeling of there's a killer out there. We don't know what he looks like. And there's no way to find out. Like, you don't have the DNA evidence yet. You don't have the surveillance cameras everywhere. Everybody doesn't have their own personal camera in the form of an iPhone. Mm. There are all of these things that we take for granted now that just were not a thing back then. And then on top of all that, you have the question mark of having to wait. Having to wait is a thing that we don't really have to do anymore as much. You know, there are times when we have to wait for things, like when you're dealing with government or law, things just go at a certain speed because that's how long it takes to do things. But it's not like, you know, now, like, if you want something, you can go on the internet and order it and maybe it'll be there in 2 days or less, you know, if you get overnight. And if you get lost going to somebody's house, you can text them and say, I'm late. And you don't really get, nobody really gets lost anymore.
Never.
And there have been times where, like, my phone is dead or I left it at home and I get lost and I'm like walking in New York and I'm like, excuse me, how do you get to such and such a place? And I can't remember the last time somebody said, you walk up this street three blocks and you make a left and then you go another two blocks and you make a right. That's not how people give directions anymore. They take out their phone.
Yes.
They take, and the first question somebody asks, if you're like, do you know how to get to such and such a place? I'm lost. Is they're like, don't you have a phone? It's a whole different world.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Anything?
You don't have to stay.
Are you kidding? This is the most interesting date I've ever had.
Paul?
Robert.
Yes?
You sitting down?
Yes.
You're not gonna believe this.
And the fact that, like, it didn't occur to him that you know, that Avery is exposed in this, what is it, an office park or something.
What's even more glaring is that Avery gets out of his car. He walks into a, or he walks through a gas station.
But
it's a dilapidated gas station that looks like something out of Terminator. He walks through.
It really does look like I personally, like, I don't like the best characters in movies, but I personally would not have gone there.
No.
I would take one look at that and go, this looks like where the Zodiac killer would kill me. And I would stay in my car. Well, and also just the idea that you got to go meet somebody at a certain place to get certain information. Like it's, you know, like it's the parking garage scene in All the President's Men or something like that. Like,
yes.
You know, nowadays, you know, my first question as a reporter, I can't remember the last time somebody said, I have very important information to you, but we have to meet in person so I can tell you. I mean, I don't normally report those sorts of stories for one thing, but also if they did say that, I would say, why don't you just tell me now? We're on the phone.
Yeah.
You know, or can't you text it to me? I mean, like, are you afraid of surveillance? Like, what's going on? I mean, there are reasons obviously why people would want to talk about this stuff face to face, but it's just not it's not as common a thing. And even storytelling is affected by that. Like, you know, just watching Curb Your Enthusiasm, their characters are constantly, it's a Los Angeles show, but it's kind of like Seinfeld. You know, Seinfeld was a New York show that was shot on location in Los Angeles, and so is Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yes.
Because of the way people are constantly dropping in on each other, running into each other on the street. It's not really an LA thing, and the way that it's a New York thing.
Yes.
You know, like in certain neighborhoods of New York, like people in your profession, if there's a lot of you who live there, you are going to run into people all the time. But it's not like Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's so funny to me because they basically kind of transplanted the customs of New York City onto that, and including like showing up at somebody's house. Like that's still a New York thing. Like if you live in a neighborhood, to just go over to somebody's house. And I even sometimes would yell up into a window, like it's on the waterfront, you know, like, hey, Bill, you home? Like that's a thing you would do in an East Coast city where it's very dense. And that's not a thing you would do out there. But you know, all of these things are just like a huge culture shock when you're watching Zodiac. And it's funny to watch that with like, you know, somebody of my kids' generation, because yes. The first thing people ask is why didn't he just call, or why, you know, like why can't he just call his friend and see if he's okay, because you can't, that's not a thing you can do, you know. And this idea that his friend is out there exposed and could be killed and he would not know about it and there's no way to warn him, that adds a whole level to the suspense that wouldn't be there if this were set in, you know, 2021. You wouldn't know. They might take days to find out that he was killed.
Yeah.
They might not even find the body. And there would be no evidence. You know, like now, like people think they've cased a place if they're going to commit a violent crime. And it turns out they forgot about something, or they didn't know about something. They didn't know about a Ring camera, or they didn't count on, you know, the FedEx guy is like, you know, calling his bookie, and he sees the thing happen and he stops talking to his bookie and he turns his phone around and takes some video, and that's how you catch the guy.
Yes.
Like there's so many ways that you cannot get away with it.
Bizarre twist, the hunted has become Hunter. San Francisco Chronicle reporter and Zodiac target Paul Avery claims to have uncovered new information regarding the only unsolved homicide in Riverside County's history, a 1966 Southern California murder that Avery now believes was the Zodiac's first victim.
What?
I didn't call you about this?
The Riverside killer wrote to the press letters that I then took personally to the Office of Question Documents.
And what did this expert tell you?
What I knew in my gut, Ron. The handwriting matches Zodiac's.
How'd you get the evidence out of Riverside?
He took it to Charlotte without telling us, the son of a bitch.
You know how bad this looks.
Hey, how do we know that this lead is real?
It's very real. You know how I know? Because I saw it on TV.
Here's Jan Johans on women as the hidden MVPs of Zodiac.
The women are kind of the MVPs of Zodiac, but they're the hidden ones. Like, they're not in the exciting duos that try to solve this, like the various cops and Avery and Graysmith, or then Graysmith and Toski, or they're not part of these duos, but they're interesting because they're the first to sense danger throughout the entire movie.
Yes.
I think it's because women know how scary men can be in the most literal sense. And it's just in our DNA and it's, you know, history. But at the beginning of the movie, yeah.
Everything.
Yes. And everything else, yes. At the beginning of the movie, it is Darlene who knows not to eat at the drive-in. Like, we can see that something was bothering her.
Yes.
She knows to tell the kid she's with, who is like, you know, fuck off and die, which is just hilarious.
One of the greatest, from Lee Norris really plays is. Mike Majeure. It's one of the greatest, like, impotent lines ever said in cinema. The way he screeches, fuck off and die. It's so bad.
Yes. It's like he's play acting what he thinks he's supposed to do, the masculine role he's supposed to play. And she's the one that tells him, like, don't get out of the car.
Don't get out of the car.
Yep. And again, at the attack at the lake, it's the woman who senses the danger.
Pell James, yeah, playing Cecilia Shepherd. She's unbelievable.
She is. She is the one who knows how serious this strange, threatening man is. And the young, misguided idealist she's with tries to reason with him, but she knows right away they're fucked. I mean, before the guy even comes up to them. And he's like, oh, honey, well, you know, it's a public park, and kind of that thing that women get all the time. Like, no, you're being paranoid. Like, to use an example from my own situation that I was referencing earlier with my health, when I first started to have some really weird symptoms, including like crazy tachycardia and shortness of breath, I'd go to the ER and they would look at my age and be like, she's 30. Honey, did your boyfriend break up with you? Like, I literally was asked that like a couple times, right, by people, like, did you get in a fight with your boyfriend? And it's like, bitch, no. I mean, the men asking me this. And I only say bitch to men like that. So,
because I saw it on TV.
Dave, you know Milton Nikolai. He's working the case for justice.
Good to see you again, Mel.
All due respect, can someone explain to me why I'm reading about breaks in this case in the Chronicle instead of getting calls from you?
We got screwed. Dave, come on. You do get your name in the paper a lot. People talk.
I don't ever talk about an open investigation, period. Okay, Ken?
Dave? Hey. Hi. Paul Avery. Can I catch a ride with you, gents?
Not a good idea, Paul.
You can make me take a cab, or we're going to the same place.
Before we play cleanup at Riverside with Mark Ruffalo's Dave Toski and Donna Logue's Ken Nalo, here's Meg Shields on her perspective of Chloe Savigny.
The idea of someone risking it all and risking the safety of others in order to feel satisfaction, like personal satisfaction at having solved the riddle. Like, Gray Smith kind of it's very selfish, everything he does.
Yes.
Which, and this is a good segue to talk about an issue I do have with the film, which is how it uses Chloe Sevigny.
Great.
Because I think the film, I mean, here's the thing, like Fincher's, as you said, a very smart man. And in this film especially, he treats his audience as being very intelligent. And what's great about police movies and file cabinet movies like this is there are great ways to smuggle in exposition, because that's a part of how it works. So it never really feels like exposition, and you never feel as if things are being explained to you. You feel like you're along for the ride.
Yes.
And the one kind of weak hinge on the door where it does feel like Fincher is like, shit, are they gonna know? I should probably say it explicitly, is with Chloe Sevigny, who plays Gray Smith's wife, Melanie. And their first date is really excellent, because there's a lot of show don't tell about it's the most anxious scene in the movie, in my opinion, when he shows up to the date and clearly his mind is not on the date. His mind is solving the Zodiac murders.
and also that his friend's life's in danger. And so it's like, I still went on a date, even though I think my friend might die.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the work being done in that scene shows us everything that gets told to us more explicitly, and in my opinion, lazily later. Where you have scenes where Sevigny says things like very, like, I'm not paraphrasing, where she's like, why are you doing this? And it feels not insulting to your intelligence as a viewer, but it does start to turn that character, who again is a real life person, into more of that kind of bummer wife archetype.
Yes.
Which on the one hand, I understand, because, you know, I understand that she's there to underline the fact that, you know, Gyllenhaal is obsessive and ready to risk it all for a staring contest. But at the same time, I don't know, her explicitly kind of laying it out is a little clunky, in my opinion.
That's a good take from a first viewing, and I don't think it's a wrong one, because it's something that I've liked. But I think part of the reason why I think she is incisive and has like really direct lines like that is because you get caught up in his obsession, forgetting that he's a real human being. Like, in normal serial killer fiction or just like procedurals, you kind of get these cops who like go off and do stuff with their lives, and like they can get obsessed, you know, even like Gyllenhaal himself in, say, like Prisoners. He's like a single dude. He's like back in town. He's from a big city. He comes back to the small town to investigate this case. He can stay up all night, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Doesn't matter. And what I like about her character is at the beginning, she shows the kind of like how enticing it might be to be dating someone who's like in the middle of this case. And it's exciting because it's San Francisco and it's great. But then when he has to be a grown up and lead a family, like she's got to parent him. I find her more like her relationship with him sort of devolves into like, I have to parent you because you're not parenting our children. You're not parenting your child. You're not here as an active participant. And the decay of his family that's happening in real time, like, I think it's like, it just speaks to tragedy to me. I never think of her as a bummer wife. I'm like, he's a bummer to live with. He's a bummer.
No, sure. I think another way of saying, or of being clearer about what I meant is, so he, like, when he does lose her, right, for that moment, or in the film where she leaves a note and says, I've taken the kids, we're going to my mom's, he's upset for like a fraction of a second. And then he's like, oh, back to the crime, which is like perfectly fine, right? Like that's the point, is that he isn't thinking about the people in his life and he's too caught up in the obsessiveness of it all. I just find that everything she does that's explicit could be done a lot more powerfully if it was shown instead of told very explicitly, where it feels like I'm being explained, where it's like Fincher just popping up and going, he's gonna lose his family because he's so obsessed. And I'm like, yeah, I fucking know, David. Like, I don't know. It just feels like not a waste of a 70, but just she does such good work that it was disappointing when she had her moments where she was exposition wife of being like, I'm here to tell you why my husband's humanity is slipping. Me, the woman in the movie.
Like, she could have had a few moments of explaining, and then by the time she was leaving, her absence, like just the house being empty is enough. Because he's left with necessarily then potentially is his gigantic corkboard, as we've talked about a couple of times, you know?
Yeah, like I'm not saying I want more 70 as much as that is usually a good thing. I actually think the story might be served by less 70. Mm.
You know what this needs?
Yeah.
It's a little bit more 70.
A little more. No, I actually think if she were, some of the more explicit nature of some of her lines were walked back a bit, it would have been more powerful. Because I think that Fincher trusts us to you know, connect.
I like
dots.
That you call him David like he's in trouble. Yeah, I get it, David. Jesus.
Yeah, it's very funny. Just become Alexis from Schitt's Creek. David. Stop using your wife characters like that, David. Yeah, I think like Detective Tashi Station, which is now what I'm going to call him, is he have a wife moment where he's like sad and listening to jazz and she's like on the phone with Jake Gyllenhaal and she's like, stop bothering my husband. You're obsessive. And we're like, again, we know. Like, I don't know. I felt like a lot of the wife characters in this film could have been labeled concerned wife of obsessed area man number one.
Sherry Jo Bates attended Riverside Community College. She studies in the library the night of October 30th, 1966. She leaves with an unidentified male at closing, 9 p.m. Her body's found the next morning in a parking lot, stabbed to death. A typewritten confession was sent to the Riverside Press Enterprise on November 29th, a month after Bates' murder. They ran it.
I'm not sick, I am insane, but that will not stop the game. This letter should be published for all to read. He wants to be published. He calls it a game. I mean, this could be our boy.
6 months later, the police, the girl's father, and the paper, they all received these. Double postage, just like Zodiac.
These are what Sherwood Morrow matched to the Zodiac letters?
These in the desktop, Don. This was found a couple of months later by a janitor in RCC storage.
Sherwood got a handwriting match off wood? Who etches in their own handwriting?
To be honest with you, our letters and your letters, I don't see it.
How did Paul Avery get his hands on the exemplars?
I gave them to him. We talked on the phone the other day for about an hour, and I told him you were going to be here.
You told him we were meeting?
Yeah. I also told him we don't think this is Zodiac.
Okay, wait a minute. You don't think this is Zodiac?
We got a guy we like for it. We don't have enough to pin it on him yet. But we're pretty sure it's him.
If you don't think this is Zodiac, then why give anything to Avery?
I'm trying to cooperate.
Oh, that's how you cooperate? By giving information to reporters?
Look, I don't know about the handwriting, but Sherwood says it's a match, right? So let's just say that your guy did Sherry Joe. He types the confession, Zodiac reads it in the paper, and he writes a letter taking credit for it. Now, that's something he's done before.
Look, now you have everything we have. But in my opinion, you guys came south for nothing.
Prove it, gentlemen, prove it.
I don't care what he says. He still could be Z. Problem is, the entire state already thinks it is. Well, there's your press agent. Talk to him about it.
Punk piece, I don't want any trouble. Dave?
Well, they don't want to talk to you right now, Paul.
Just trying to do my job.
Oh, really? Well, now I can't do mine. We already screwed up the amount of tips we got on this thing, and you've just freaked out the entire state. I've got Napa, Vallejo, and DOJ looking at me sideways, and Riverside's telling me I'm on a snipe hunt.
Jesus, hey, Sherry Joe Bates was a gift. I gave that to you. You and Armstrong never would have found
this. This may not be Zodiac. Does that matter to you? Does it matter that Riverside may not be able to make a case against their suspect because of you?
Tell it to Sherwood. I'm out here beating the bushes, trying to draw him out. We're in this together.
Well, we're not in anything together, Paul, because I'm not interested in upping my circulation.
Oh, boy. You wrote me. You threatened my life.
Hey, bullet.
Been a year and a half. You gonna catch this fucking guy or not?
Go fuck yourself.
Happily.
You should have called me, Paul.
Yep. As we wrap up, the final word I'll leave to two men involved directly in the scene. First up, Donald Logue, who plays Ken Narlow, talking about how this scene was one of his very favorites on the film. And secondly, James Vanderbilt, the writer of Zodiac, talking about the importance of the friction between Paul Avery and Dave Toski in this scene.
I think my favorite moment in Zodiac was, and I don't mean to jump the gun, but there's a scene where we go down to Riverside. We fly down to Riverside, and Downey Jr.'s on the flight with us, Paul, right? And we're bummed that this reporter's with us, and we don't want to talk to him. And we go into talk to the Riverside PD, and there's a desk, and is the handwriting match, but it's an etching in a desk and all this stuff. And then Mark Ruffalo and Robert Downey Jr. have this confrontation in the parking lot out in front. And I remember it was
with the immortal line. Hey, bullet.
Hey, bullet.
When are you going to fucking catch this guy? It's just a mic drop.
And the notepad, you know, yeah. And Mark, Mark was sick that day. Like, he had a fever, and kind of like those great athletes, like Michael Jordan with 103 degree fever pouring in 38 points or something, you know. But he was almost in tears, and he's like, when, and he understood Fincher's style of working better as well as, or better than anyone else. But I remember him saying, when are we going to get this, man? When do you have it? And he goes, you know, I'll tell you when. And it was just so enthralling to watch these two guys at the top of their game throwing down like that. It was just, I mean, you know, it's like one of those things you like having a ringside seat for. It was so cool. And
well, it was, I mean, we found it extremely funny, you know, that the idea that you know, Toski is someone who likes seeing his name in the paper, likes to talk to reporters, like cuts a, you know, sort of a dandy figure.
Yes.
And would be sort of accused, you know, side-eyed by other cops of like, hey, you're the guy who talks to reporters too much. And then deny it, and then have Avery show up on the same flight. Like, we just, the fact that happened, we thought was sort of so funny and delicious, and we kind of leaned into the comedy of it.
Yeah, we got screwed here, and then he's
right there,
and he pokes his, he even like comes inside of frame. Hey guys, and you're like, oh god,
he wants, can we share a cab? Like, it's the, you know, it's, and he's kind of fucking with him too, because he knows they're not really happy. I also do love that he is sitting in the last, he goes back to sit in the smoking section on the plane. Yes. But the other thing, you know, if I'm remembering it right, we were really careful about Toski swearing. Mm. And Toski doesn't really curse very often in the movie at all, because we knew we wanted him to say, when he said, go fuck yourself, Paul, that for Dave Toski to use good, you know, good Catholic boy Dave Toski to use that kind of language, really meant something, you know?
Yeah.
And that was about the worst thing he could say to you. So sort of weirdly, we wanted to build to that.
That concludes the 12th episode of Zodiac Chronicle, Gemini, Part 2. Be sure to subscribe, rate, review, follow the show wherever you can to be the first to know about all upcoming episodes. If you can't get enough, for as little as $1 a month, you can find Unplugged Zodiac Sessions podcast exclusively on the One Heat Minute Patreon. The link to that is in our show notes. This episode of Zodiac Chronicle was researched, written, and presented by me, Blake Howard. The music of Zodiac Chronicle is composed, produced, and performed by Chris Duffy of Los Espinas. Thank you, The Duff. Our companion, I Am Not Avery, Zodiac Chronicle pins and stickers were designed by the incredibly talented Amy Reed, who you can find on Instagram at ai.me.me or via email at amy.reed0310@gmail.com. And if you want to help the show, you can buy them. Every little couple of bucks counts, whether you're a patron, whether you're buying some of our incredible merch with the awesome design of our logo from Brianna Ashby. It helps us to continue to produce these shows. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.
Goodbye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.